Call the Tax Committee to order. First bill on our agenda today, Senator Dibble, Senate File 3534.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What Senate File 3534 seeks to accomplish is to allow the City of Minneapolis make use of the some of the increment that results from the increase in value and property taxes from the housing replacement districts that it has available to it to use for homes that are vacant, boarded, and otherwise in need of attention, the city's attention, because of our foreclosure housing crisis. I should mention, Mr. Chair and members, the first two sections of the bill in front of you were in the tax bill that we just passed, and so those actually probably could be deleted. Section 3 is the focus of this bill, where it says revenues derived from the tax increments from the housing replacement district for activities related to parcels not identified in the housing replacement plan. So those are housing units, housing parcels that aren't a part of the 400, which is the increase that was in the tax bill.
First bill.
But would qualify for inclusion under Section 45. That rest of that language refers to the same kind of houses, the houses that are structurally substandard, vacant, or vacant sites. And, Mr. Chair, the reason the city would like to be able to do this, of course, is because of the housing foreclosure crisis and the large number of houses that quickly need attention from the city, for which the city doesn't have available resources, maintaining the properties, boarding them, getting them getting some attention.
Just started.
Your witness.
Mr. Chair, this is Sherry Pugh from the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers.
Good morning. My name is Sherry Pugh Sullivan. I'm the Executive Director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. We are a 36-year-old nonprofit resident council, one of the oldest in the city of Minneapolis. Our neighborhood over the last 30 to 40 years has seen great transition. From the 1960s, we had vacant lots and boarded properties, but over a 20-year span, we worked to rebuild our community, so much so that by 2000, we had achieved home ownership in our neighborhoods in Willard Hay of 60% and in the Near North community of over 35%. We thought that we were on our way. However, we were egregiously attacked by the predatory lending practices that have now crossed the entire state and the nation, and we are sustaining significant challenges in our community. If you can imagine, in our neighborhoods, we now, of the 560 vacant and boarded properties in the city, 400 of them are within the 13 neighborhoods of North Minneapolis. We are extremely challenged. We are here today to say to you that we know in order to address the issue of boarded properties, to try and retain and sustain the housing that's going through foreclosures, which still is escalating in our neighborhood, we need several different attacks to tools to address that. The state is already responding to the predatory lending issues. Job loss is one of our challenges. Family crisis is one of our challenges. Crime and social inequity. But we know that through fostering and supporting nonprofit organizations and community groups, we can rehabilitate the homes in our community through policies such as the bill before you. It can help facilitate the acquisition and the management of the housing stock. And the implementation of effective land use will also assist us in redeveloping our community. I had some handouts that were passed out to you, and if you look, to give you a sense of the level of activity and what's going on, one is a map of the city of Minneapolis, which shows you the many dots for loans that have foreclosures in the city. If you look at the North Minneapolis, that northwest quadrant, you'll see that we're almost a blob. We're not just distinguished dots anymore. That shows you the level of foreclosures. When you look at the maps, especially when you look at that 27th and 21st Avenue, 21st Avenue, of that one, well, 21st and Penn, is actually in the neighborhood we work in. Within one block, on one side of the street, we have five abandoned and boarded properties just within one block. So you can imagine when every other house on your block is boarded and has been condemned, the impact on those who are still living there trying to hold on to their ownership and their community. I think the maps in themselves show you a sample of the devastation that is going on in our community. We've been coming to the legislature for the last 3 years talking about this issue. We are now at the crisis point, and we hope that you will support us in this effort.
Ms. Pugh, the language allows you to use the revenue for activities related to the parcels. Could you give us a, if the committee wanted to kind of narrow that up a little bit, maybe define some activities. It seems pretty open-ended. Could we give a little more definition to what activities related to the parcels might be?
Well, I think the activities related to the parcels are acquisition. That's the first activity. The renovation or demolition of the property and building a new home. There are things that we as a community group do as value-added. We are very into reforesting our community, so that would be a value-added piece because we have other resources to obtain trees, to reforest. We have interest through our NRP money to make sure the sidewalks are correct and maybe help people with some ornamental things. So I think that this bill is really dealing with the house structure, and that is acquiring, acquisition, rehab, and new construction. Is that correct?
Chair Bunny Balich is here, who can help also.
Mr. Balich, a little closer definition of what activities might be.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Balich, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Minneapolis. And one thing that I wanted to make clear is that this bill does not change any of the original program criteria or intent. And the intent of the original program was just to allow cities to use these dollars to acquire and demolish vacant and boarded sites for production of market rate housing. I'm sorry, my voice is barely hanging in here. But there's no change in the original program. The original program was put into place, and I think like half a dozen cities were authorized to establish these housing replacement districts.
I think, Ms. Balich, I think if that's the intent, we probably want to define activities to those outlined in paragraph A, which are the uses currently allowed. It's on the top of page A. Or no, it starts on the bottom of page 2. The revenues must be used solely to pay for site acquisition, relocation, demolition of existing structures, site prep, and pollution abatement. Is that... We're looking at talking about the same uses?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's the original uses that were allowed under the original language. If you were more comfortable with just referring to original statute, that would be fine, too. We didn't intend to expand upon anything that wasn't already authorized.
Because the B, Senator Dibble, the B paragraph says notwithstanding paragraph A. So...
Right.
I think if we'll have council work on that, I think, but I think if you're okay with the same uses that are allowed currently for this new activity, maybe we can just make a reference to the uses are the same as in paragraph A.
Mr. Chair, that was our intent. Thank you.
Sorry, but so, we'll just have council work on that.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know if it's important to have a motion now or not, but Section 1 and Section 2, I mean, are we just laying these on the table?
Yeah, we'll delete.
So Section 1 and Section 2 don't need to be included.
Right, we don't need them. And then I'm wondering if Senator Dibble, what if we had a sunset on it and 5 years from now we had to kind of come back and take a look at the kind of work that's been done, see how well it's, how the expanded program is working? And
I think that would be wise, Mr. Chair.
So I think maybe we'll consider that also. Does 5 years seem reasonable?
It's a good start.
Hopefully we'll be through our mortgage crisis
yes.
by then.
All right. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Chair lays over Senate File 3534 for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Just want to see what we're thinking.
Yeah. Okay.
Senator Clark? Senator Clark has Senate File 2841.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, we do have a delete everything amendment.
Senator Larson moves. Is this the first committee this bill's been to?
Yes, sir.
Senator Larson moves the A2 amendment. Members, this is a delete all. This is the first bill that... First committee, the bill's been in front of, so this gets the bill in the shape the author wants it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to start off quickly and then turn it over to Ms. Avner and Mr. Hagan. As I believe committee members know, in December there was a Supreme Court decision that raised a lot of concerns within the nonprofit community, but also some concerns within the assessor community. And what had happened was the belief that there would be a fairly limited scope of what would be constituted as a charity as opposed to a broader ranged test, which is what people believed was being used. What we have found, though, is there's a variety of ways that assessors actually get to figuring out whether or not an entity should be considered to be tax exempt. And at this point, what the Delete Everything Amendment does is, and it is agreed upon between the parties, is a moratorium for a year, because the goal is to have the status quo. We want to make sure that we are continuing to have entities exempt that should be exempt, and where they shouldn't be, they shouldn't be. But we want to make sure we also can get some further clarity within the law. So there are two things that are being done here. First off, like I said, is the moratorium. The other piece is that there is a working group that is working together to come up with recommendations for us to look at next year. So the goal really is that nobody would either have more of a burden financially on the local level or to put nonprofits who clearly do a variety of types of things, everything from the arts to Head Start, to housing development, to health care. And we want to make sure that we still maintain a strong nonprofit community. So I have two people here this morning, Mr. Chair. First, Ms. Avner from the Council of Nonprofits, and second, Mr. Hagan from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marcia Avner, and I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. The Council of Nonprofits is a statewide association with almost 2,000 nonprofit organizations as members. We are enthusiastically supportive of the moratorium. Many of you are aware of the case that came forward, the ruling that came forward from the Supreme Court of Minnesota in early December under the Rainbow Child Care Center versus Goodhue County. In that, we perceive a restriction of the factors to be considered in determining whether or not a nonprofit is a purely public charity and eligible for the property tax exemption. We began immediately to have discussions with county assessors and with the Department of Revenue. We've met with the Department of Revenue staff and leaders over a two-month period now. And we have, I think, reached a sincere and genuine and productive agreement that this creates an opportunity for us to examine rigorously what the factors ought to be that should be considered in ways that are fair and reasonable and predictable for nonprofits. There's been a lot of concern on the part of nonprofits that the court ruling would be more restrictive. The uncertainty is really troubling. The types of organizations that have been most concerned are groups like community mental health facilities, residential care facilities. And so we're really happy with the idea of a moratorium, and with the sincere and already in action commitment from both nonprofits and revenue involving assessors to work on those fair and reasonable standards. So we're very supportive of this approach. We hope that you will be too, and we have every hope of bringing a really solid and well-developed piece of legislation to you in the next legislative session that we think will codify the standards in the way that's probably been needed for quite some time. This has always been dealt with in case law. The court itself said this should be the purview of the legislature and not the court. Thank you, and thank you, Senator Clark, for your support.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division in the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee, and I would like to add my support in the departments to Senate File 2841 that provides for a temporary moratorium on the assessment changes to institutions of purely public charity. The moratorium would apply to all properties that are currently exempted as institutions of purely public charity and would contain an exception for changes in ownership, changes in occupancy, changes in use, and there would be also a potential if a property was already a 501c3 corporation was already tax that would not limit the valuation to either go up or down. We do recognize that in the case of a moratorium, we need to find a way to deal with the newly formed, newly constructed, or newly acquired properties. And we're proposing that we set up a review committee composed of Department of Revenue representatives, representatives from nonprofits, as well as representatives from the assessment community. And what we anticipate we deal with is we'd ask assessors dealing with new applications for institutions of purely public charity to forward the application together with any information that would speak to their exemption to us, and we make a determination collectively on the tax status of that property during the moratorium time. We do believe that it is extremely important that property tax administrators and institutions of purely public charity have clear and understandable guidelines for what qualifies for exemption and what does not. We believe it's imperative that properties are treated similarly in different taxing jurisdictions, and these properties can depend on their tax status, either that they will be taxable, that they will be exempt from one year to the next. The department, the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, other stakeholders, including Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, are all in agreement that we neither want to expand or contract the existing universe on exempt properties. Having said that, we do recognize that there will be some properties that we will identify during the course of our survey and during the course of our work that some properties that are improperly exempted that likely will be taxed and some that are likely improperly taxed that will move into the exempt category. The group will be charged with the task of developing, as Ms. Avner said, clear guidelines for what qualifies as an exemption of purely public charity and will be composed of representatives of nonprofits, Department of Revenue staff, House and Senate staff, and representatives of the assessment community. I'm very optimistic about this collaborative approach that we're undertaking, and I believe it will provide clear guidelines for assessors going forward into the future. Thank you. Senator Clark reminds me that we do have a time issue in this, if you do endorse the recommendation or the bill, including a moratorium, because it would be for the 2008 assessment, which they're well underway right now. They're sending out valuation notices. So timeliness is a problem. We don't want to wait until the end of the session to deal with the issue. So there's a number of ways that it could be dealt with. There's a special bill that went through and was passed into law, or perhaps, as we discussed, the possibility of maybe a letter from the chair of the Senate and House Tax Committees authorizing or instructing us to go ahead with a moratorium, which would allow us to go forward.
I think I'll talk with counsel about the tax chair in the House and Senate writing a letter to the department.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be a good solution.
Anything else, Senator Clark?
No, Mr. Chair, unless there's any questions.
Ms. Avner, anything else?
No, we appreciate your consideration of this.
Thank you. Senator Waugh moves that Senate File 2841 as amended be held over for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So wouldn't have to reconsider?
Yeah.
Senator Moi, Senate File 3162.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 3162. These provisions obviously have already gone through this committee once and were part of the bill that was vetoed last time around. There's one additional change to the language of the bill, Mr. Chair. Basically, the bill provides a sales tax exemption to the Metropolitan Council or the Department of Transportation for the purchase of vehicles and repair parts related to the North Star Corridor rail project. And the new addition to the bill asks for that exemption of the construction materials to be extended to the Central Corridor. And in addition, we're asking for construction materials, including track and signal improvements, stations, park and ride facilities, and maintenance facility. And we ask that the tax be imposed and then refunded. And we ask that all the exemptions are effective retroactive for sales and purchases after January 1, 2007. I have Commissioners McDonough and Commissioner McLaughlin here to speak to the bill.
Commissioners, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner. I'll speak to the Central Corridor issue and the sales tax exemption request. The total impact to Central Corridor from, and these are Met Council numbers, is about $10.9 million to about $13 million, which would have an immediate impact on the budget and the planning process for us to position Central Corridor with the FTA as we're competing with other lines throughout the country to get the federal matching dollars. Currently, that $10 to $13 million is being included in the budget as a sales tax item. If we can get this exemption, that will free up those dollars to help us meet the FTA requirement of a 2399 CEI, and I think most of you are familiar with that. That's been talked about a lot, and it will actually be dollars that can be used to be reinvested in the line. So the long-term benefit of this exemption really helps strengthen that line. I think the other thing that I would clearly like to point out about the sales tax exemption is that is shared, that sales tax, if we don't have that exemption, is shared with the federal dollars, the state dollars, and the local dollars, which means for Ramsey County property tax dollars, that's about our share of that without the exemption would be about $1 million of property tax dollars that would actually be going to pay sales tax, which becomes a little frustrating if we're going to use property tax dollars for this line. We'd much rather see it as an investment in the line that gives benefits to the people in the community. With that information, I would stand for any questions about this exemption for Central Corridor, and I know Commissioner McLaughlin will talk about
it. Senator Dibble.
I'll wait.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority, a Hennepin County Commissioner, and also chair of the Metro Transit Ways Development Board, which is the seven-county joint powers board of all the regional railroad authorities in the metropolitan area. The Metro Transit Ways Development Board has supported this legislation for a number of years. We appreciate the support from this committee in the past. We are trying to level the playing field here. Right now, there's the LRT vehicle and repair parts are currently exempt from the sales tax, but commuter rail vehicles are not. We think that ought to be made consistent so that both are exempt. On the construction materials, Minnesota is one of the few states that actually puts a sales tax on local units of government, and it puts us at a disadvantage as we compete for federal funds, which are going to provide half of the cost of these rail lines. Because it's a cost of doing business, as Commissioner McDonough indicated, it's in excess of $13 million for the Central Corridor. That's a cost that rail lines in most states don't have to bear. And so it puts us at a competitive disadvantage. And so we are advocating in this bill that North Star Commuter Rail be provided with the exemption. This for both construction materials and vehicle and repair parts, as well as supporting the Central Corridor request for the exemption for construction materials. The total impact of this would be $5.6 million for the North Star Corridor. So, Mr. Chairman, we hope that you can be supportive. Judge Chetnan from Met Council is on his way. I don't believe he's here yet, but he was intending to come and support, testify in support of this legislation. And Mr. Mark Furman is here for any technical questions that you might have.
Thank you. Commissioner McLaughlin, I don't have to explain to you the budget situation we've got on our hands in the current biennium. What if the tax committee had to delay your eligibility for a refund until July of 2009 to get it in? Not that the 10-11 biennium is in any better situation, but the current situation is the current biennium. Would that create a problem?
Mr. Chairman, are you suggesting that in terms of the total amount of the exemption would not change? This is a cash flow issue, or is it that in the current biennium, the estimate is that $4.7 million in exemption would be provided to North Star in this as a one-time tax exemption, and then there's $900,000 that would be in subsequent biennium, the 2011 biennium. Is your question?
My suggestion is, how about if we agree with you on the bill but put off that you can't file a refund application until January or July 2009, which puts us in the next biennium?
That would be fine, Mr. Chairman.
It doesn't create a cash flow problem.
We can deal with that. Thank you.
And I don't know I'm very – Senator Cohen and Senator Pogelmeier and I have had discussions about trying not to do things that make our tails problem in 10 and 11 worse, but – we've got a more immediate situation in the current biennium that we need to find a way to deal with. So if we can, we should have a discussion later maybe about whether that is something that might be acceptable.
Fine. We'd be happy to work with you on that.
Okay. Senator Mwah?
Mr. Chair, that's before Mr. McLaughlin said, I already agreed that that's the solution, we should go ahead and do that.
Senator Dibble.
That was the gist of what I was going to inquire, but I would like to at least bookmark this whole subject for a better day when we don't have the same budget struggles. This whole subject of taxing ourselves, the local government. We've had a little bit of that conversation in the past, but these major public works projects that we tax, seems like we're chasing our tail on these things. It's a larger policy discussion.
Yeah, I think, Senator Dibble, if we ever have $100 million laying around, we should arm wrestle Senator Cohen for the money and not put ourselves through this process with our local governments, because I do think we're treating them unfairly.
It's more than $100 million.
Senator Pogelmeier.
The counterpoint is that building real costs into things creates efficiency. Now, when you're talking about purely public facility, that's a different matter. But if you're talking about something that in some sense could have been in the private sector, mm-hmm. there's an equity issue there, too. Mm-hmm. It's food for thought.
Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3162 for possible inclusion in the committee bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Larson, Senate File 3043.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Senate File 3043 is a non-refundable tax credit called the Equity and Opportunity in Education Tax Credit. An individual under this bill or corporation will be allowed a credit against individual income tax or corporate franchise tax. Maximum credit would be $10,000 for individual filers, $20,000 for married joint filers, and $100,000 for corporate filers. The proposal limits the statewide credit available for any taxable year at $10 million. Mr. Chair and members, this credit is targeted at schools who have at least 15% student population at 2 times of poverty or less. And so this is an opportunity for us to create an opportunity to join with the private sector in creating opportunities for kids with limited means, who come from families with limited means. This would encourage contributions to scholarship organizations that will benefit low-income K-12 students at both public and private schools. And it's an attempt to create equity and opportunity for all students across Minnesota. The goal of this legislation is to help Minnesota's children that are living in poverty and help public schools through educational programming, private schools through tuition scholarships, and again create that public-private partnership that can allow for an infusion into our school systems, both public and private, that will that again is focused on the kids in Minnesota with the greatest need. Mr. Chair, again, the bill has a $10 million cap. It has a 5-year sunset. It has a study in here so that we can take a look as we've moved through this pilot project, if you will, and see if we're receiving results from it. This legislation is modeled after legislation that passed in Pennsylvania. And the experience in Pennsylvania when they started 6 years ago was a $30 million cap annually. They have more than doubled that cap and are at $75 million currently, signaling to us that there's a feeling of great success with this program. Members, this is to some degree a little bit of a departure for me as I've dug into this issue. I have been reluctant to go down the road of tax credits for public for education. On the other hand, the more that I see that the kids in our state who are from families of low income, we need to target more dollars there. And if we can leverage private contributions to help organizations that are empowered to prepare those kids for a successful education process in the K through 12 education process, then I think that we are making a positive step in Minnesota. I have with me today a number of people that would like to provide testimony, and so I will at this time turn it over to Jim Field, who is with an organization called Coalition for Kids, and we'll have additional testifiers both from the public schools and the private schools. Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Larson. Maybe with your departure from your normal position on this, we will be able to get somewhere with this now this year. Thank you for bringing it.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing us to bring this before you. I would like to take just a couple minutes to explain myself.
Name and who you represent.
I'm sorry, Jim Field from the Coalition for Kids. I moved to Minnesota on October 5th, 1970, to be a street worker. I learned that trade in Chicago. One of the first things I figured out about Minnesota was we were big at bragging about how our graduation rate is one of the highest in the country. One of the things I noticed dealing with street kids was if for kids of color and poverty kids were maybe 30th. On the list, and we never seem to pay enough attention to that. And I think now it's almost at a crisis point. We need to do something. We have more black college-age children, young men in prison than we have in college. And they didn't start that road for prison at the college level. They started it when they were failing in schools. This law is dedicated to those kids, the kids that come from poverty that need that extra boost to get a tutor quick when they have trouble in math or any course, not knowing how to get a tutor to work on ACT test, not being able to afford the trip, not being able to dress nice. The public schools would have this opportunity to just add support to that kid and increase the graduation rate. For private schools, it's all for scholarships for poverty level children. And we have been working with the Commission on Poverty, and they have defined their poverty as two times federal, so we're using that same definition in this law. I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the witness, or Senator Larson, you mentioned that you're using the 200% of poverty, but I've been a while since I've been on the education committees, but it seems to me that they use a measure of percentage of free and reduced lunch analyze poverty, and I'm wondering if the 200% will fit within what they're doing.
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the education law uses the free and reduced meal criteria, and our commission has decided to use the federal standard. And they do match up. We have to figure out the exact match. I can tell you it's a family of four, around $42,000. The free and reduced qualification is a little higher than that, probably family of four, $60,000. So this is even a lower level of poverty than free and reduced lunch.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, as you move forward, you want to make sure that the schools have access to that information, which I think will be the challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy. I appreciate that, and we'll follow up with you on that as well. Thank you.
Mr. Field, is this 100% credit?
Yes. That's what we put it in.
And Pennsylvania is 75?
It's 75 if you make a two-year commitment.
I thought it went to 90 if it was a two-year commitment or not.
Oh, if you make a two-year, I'm sorry. 75 if it's 1 year commitment, 90 if it's a two-year commitment.
I mean, members, I like the notion of doing something to encourage our corporations to make some investments in our schools. Sometimes tax policy works to do that. Senator Larson, I think it's a good thing for us to have a discussion about, I think, is getting a little additional corporate participation, I think, because they certainly benefit from a workforce that's well-educated and has the skill set they need and comes time to be hired. Interesting thought.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Squay.
Mr. Chair, on the part about corporations benefiting our schools, they are currently doing that, and I know in the Clearbrook-Gonvick School District that Team Industries is contributing more to a school readiness program than the state is.
Really?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I know the Minneapolis Chamber has been very active and involved in the Minneapolis public schools on a number of fronts, with a strong presence inside the schools and pulling young people out of the schools for site, kind of work site exposure opportunities. I'm working with them this year to do a college readiness proposal. Got some, and they're part of a they actively support the Minneapolis Public Schools Foundation, and they're an active participant in a roundtable work group that we have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scoy and Senator Dibble. I also have had the experience in the schools that I represent and also Minneapolis schools that the business community is interested in helping the schools. This is an attempt to intensify that. And then through the use of tax policy to target, as we allow for this $10 million to be spent annually, is to target those resources to the kids that absolutely need them the most. And try to make that impact on the poorest kids that are in our schools, and so I think it's building on the business community's desire to be helpful, and intensifying that with a little bit of an incentive for them to participate at an even greater level, and that's part of the goal of the legislation.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I just I'm just looking at this for the first time, and so I'd like more opportunity to talk to Senator Larson about it. I have to sound, you know, I have a question about directing these resources to private schools. You know, I don't think the evidence is super strong that kids, low-income kids, are benefiting from the idea that we get them out of the public schools and put them in the private schools. The evidence is just not there. And, you know, I have my own, you know, some of these sect-based, you know, religious-based private schools that are trying to use public money, I have some serious issues with.
Mr. Field, do you want to address that?
Yes. Thank you. Statewide, the private schools do serve the public. About 100,000 children in Minnesota. 10% of those children would qualify for this. And it's a gift for children of poverty that go to these schools. We have a presenter here who can talk about the Center City schools in St. Paul, Minneapolis, and their level of poverty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't agree with the statement that it's a gift for these kids to be able to necessarily go to the schools. I don't think the evidence is super strong.
Mr. Field, this is a scholarship program, right?
It's a scholarship program, yes.
Senator Larson, do you have another?
Well, Mr. Chair, the one thing that I would say to that is I think that maybe there isn't clear evidence across the board on how we address all of these things. However, it's clear to me that we're not doing enough to address circumstances for kids that are in poverty, and sometimes allowing for some choice and allowing some resources for us to have some of that choice at least provide some options. And so when we have circumstances where perhaps a public school isn't meeting that need of that particular child, there is some choice for that family. But what was important and critical for me to carry this legislation was that it was not purely for private schools, that we allow public schools to draw upon this. In Bloomington, we have a private foundation that's being started now by a longtime teacher in our school district who the district recognizes that they don't receive enough resources to meet the needs of kids that come from low-income families. And so we have to go to the private sector to try to raise enough money so that we feel like we're meeting those needs. When that's happening, it tells me that we're given that we're not meeting those needs, we have to try and find another way. And this is my attempt to find at least one other avenue for us to provide for those children.
Senator Larson, how do public schools benefit from this program?
Mr. Chair, public schools would have the opportunity through by being a qualified organization to raise money for children who are at 2 times poverty or less for tutoring programs and other educational programs where they might not otherwise be able to participate. It could be anything from helping students who go on that 3-day science trip that's impossible for their family to finance to aggressive tutoring for those students that need it and the school district can't afford to provide for it. This would allow the school district to raise dollars for that type of program.
Senator Sundrum.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Larson, I think, made the point I was going to make that qualified schools can be indeed public, but since I do have the floor, I'm just hoping that we can take a chance on this. I think, and we all know that there's challenges within certainly many of our schools and a lot of inner city schools, and to the extent that we might just take a chance on a bill like this, as Pennsylvania did, I think is seeing tremendous success. We've got to do something to get at this, and I'm not just sure this bill is enough, but I think it's the best thing I'm seeing right now in terms of putting resources into an area of our state that needs resources. We've perhaps all been on bonding trips and walked through our prisons, and it's not a pretty sight. and many of these individuals can't read or can't write, and you wonder, how did this happen? And so again, to the extent we can think seriously about this bill, and we will, I just hope that we can put it in the bill, or at least strongly consider it for inclusion, because I think it's the right thing to do.
Senator Moi.
Senator Larson, just so that I understood, I thought I heard what you said. So public schools that have a foundation that's attached to the public school district would be eligible to participate in this program to the extent that they could offer up this program to potential donors to the public schools foundations?
That's correct, Senator Moore.
But wouldn't they also have to be a qualified school?
That's correct, and we qualify the school by requiring that it have at least 15% enrollment of children that are qualify for the 2x poverty or less. And so it does have that requirement that the school be qualified to that degree. The neighborhood school that I have in Bloomington, we would qualify. There are schools in Bloomington that would qualify clearly, and there are some that would not. And so clearly, those dollars are targeted to the schools that that are going to impact those children.
Well, Senator Larson, the Senator Scoy's part, but when we already have the information on how many, what the population of what free and reduced lunch is in our schools, I mean, rather than try to go through the process and get that sensitive data about what the student population's parents' incomes are, wouldn't it be easier to just piggyback off of the free and reduced information that we already have?
That's fine.
I think, Mr. Chair, that's a good suggestion, and be happy to work to incorporate that into the bill. I don't think that there's a reason why we had it drafted this way. I think we'd be probably would make some sense to make it comparable to how the schools.
I think the number is not 15%. If we use that, I mean, I think we've got a lot of school districts in the state that are 40.
Yeah, 50.
I think Minneapolis and St. Paul are in the 60-70% range on.
Well, if you're in a good position, it's 70%. It could be as high as 90-95%.
I mean, even the school district that I personally live in is like 42.
Sure.
So I mean, if we did 15, we'd have most schools in the state probably eligible. But I do think there's probably a number somewhere between 15 and 100 that. It might be the right number. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to follow up because I'm still a little bit confused about the a school district's foundation, but then the contribution has to be specifically targeted towards a particular school that qualifies. So mechanically, I don't know how does that mean that the contributor have to designate a particular school that the money flows to when they contribute to the foundation?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Field answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moll, the way the law is written is, and it has to match the code, the charity code, so it's any 501c3. So there might be a district that has a foundation, which is a separate 501c3, and also some of the schools have. Sometimes there's a district that only has one school. That would be the 501c3, whatever qualifies for that. But the award has to go to either a poverty child, however we define that, or a poverty school. So if it was a district, say like Bloomington, if it was going to go to a specific school, would have to go to one of those poverty-qualified schools.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, to that point, and Senator Larson, I think as you move forward on this, you probably should take a look at what's going on in the state now, because I know that these schools are receiving support, but I'm also pretty sure that they don't have foundations that are receiving it. So they might be running it through a collaborative or something that's already in existence. You might want to take a look at what's going on and try to line up your language with what current practice is in Minnesota.
Senator Skoy, I think we better have counsel explain how she interprets the language in the bill relative to the foundation issue.
Mr. Chair, the foundation is actually not an organization of the school. It is a 501c3 corporation separate from the school. An individual or corporation would make a donation to the 501c3 foundation, and the foundation would make the choice to make it a grant to either a school, a qualified student, or a program in a qualified school. So the school does not have to have a foundation.
Well, and Mr. Chair, to Senate Council, how many of these 503Cs would you think might be across the state giving these grants? Is it just going to be a dozen of them, or is every kind of county going to have one?
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Field has the information as to how many of these already currently exist, these qualified foundations in Minnesota.
How many school foundations? Well, I know there's over 10,000 charities in the state. And I imagine that every school district has a 501c3. So literally it'd be all 360 school districts. Then if you take the schools, I think there are around 2,500 public schools in the state, and just about all of them are a 501c3, or as in St. Paul, the 501c3 is held by the St. Paul School District. And, of course, they have a foundation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Field, do you have any concern that currently we know for a fact that a lot of corporations are contributing to the school districts, particularly the public school districts? Is there any concern that this might create the unintended consequence of perhaps disincentivizing the additional giving once people have used up this credit, that somehow the people who are currently giving, you know, are going to look to this category to give, and then once this is used up, that somehow becomes a ceiling for the contributions?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Morrell, that's a good question. We asked that question when we went to Philadelphia to review this law, and it's increased their giving. And essentially, that's why it's increased to $75 million, because the corporation's been lining up at the door and saying, we want a part of this, we want to increase our giving. So,
well, Sir Moi, the under current federal law, they do receive a federal deduction for those contributions. So I'm assuming they'd still want it. The federal deduction's a lot higher than anything we're going to do here in Minnesota. So I don't think it would erode that. This could leverage additional, I would think.
That was my concern, Mr. Chair, that it would leverage additional contributions.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, former Senator Bob Kierlin, as you know, is a very wealthy man, and he has set up a foundation with the proceeds going to at-risk children. So I think what he is doing is paralleling what you're attempting to do here, and it'd be kind of interesting to know just how that one works. All I know is that it's a charitable foundation that, with that goal in mind, but I'm not sure just how he does it.
Thank you, Senator Langseth. I'll follow up with former Senator Kierlin. I'd love to hear about that.
Senator Larson, do you have other testifiers?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to next go with have Mr. Peter Knoll from Catholic Schools provide testimony.
Knoll,
thank you, Mr.
Chair,
members. Peter Knoll, Minnesota Catholic Conference. And we stand in support of Senator Larson's proposal. Among the attractive features of this program have already been pretty well delineated, and that is this expansion of partnerships. While expanding the partnerships to include corporations and individual donors, I think another feature of this is it kind of targets the local community with the donations. As the donations filter into these educational foundations, they target very specific issues in local communities to address the achievement gap issue. I think thus really stimulating innovative, creative measures to try and bridge the achievement gap that we've been really all striving to as public, private, charter, homeschool, educational enterprise members are trying to address that issue. Further, we support the author's proposal here to design a pilot program. We think this really provides an opportunity to study the efficacy of the program in terms of results and interest on the part of corporations, individual donors, on the part of the educational foundations, and the low-income families who are seeking the equity and opportunity in education for their children. So we think it really provides an opportunity to take a hard look at this, as they did in Pennsylvania, and see if the results and the interest would indicate that we sustain this program in Minnesota, should it pass into law, and if perhaps, as it has happened or come to fruition in Pennsylvania, it actually expanded the program. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill.
Mr. Noll, thank you. Senator Larson.
Mr. Chair, we now have Mr. Tom McCarver.
My name is Tom McCarver. I represent a group called FOCUS, Friends of Catholic Urban Schools. We organized 3 years ago when we recognized that many of our inner city schools were starting to take on a very different character than in the past. My role in the past had been at the University of St. Thomas as Dean of the School of Education from 1982 to 1990, and then as the superintendent of Catholic schools from 94 till a year ago last August. I now represent a cluster of 15 inner city schools, and we do measure carefully the number of kids on free and reduced lunch. We're at 46% of our population on free and reduced lunch. These are inner city schools, and we have roughly 3,000 kids in these schools. I don't want to duplicate any of the information that has been given, but I stand ready to answer any questions about our schools.
Thank you, Senator Larson.
Mr. Chair, there are two other individuals that would like to provide brief testimony. Mr. Jim Hansel and Mr. Ben Barato, if they could come up at this time, introduce themselves for the record. Thank you.
My name is Jim Hansel. I'm the executive director of the Winona Area Public Schools Foundation. The foundation was established in 1991, back when public school foundations were not plentiful. We were not the first, but we were among the first. And it was established to provide financial support for programs in the Winona Area Public Schools, District 861. It's legally separate from and independent of the school district, but created to support programs in that district. As you know, as I think you probably know, there's a fairly good history of philanthropy in Winona, and certainly former Senator Kierlin is among those who've done very, very good things for us. My guess is he would, I'm purely guessing, he would be in support of this program. And his company, the company he founded, would certainly be a potential donor to it, as would several other Winona area companies. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have that specifically relate to a legally separate public school foundation with a 501c3 certification.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm a board member of the Winona Area Public School Foundation. I spent 31 years in a classroom, and I'm still interested in education. I sit on the REAM board, which is a consortium of 10 units in our area, and I'm also on the state REAM board, retired educators. I'll give you just a brief look at what we have accomplished or what we fund. We provide scholarships for a number of things for students that can't afford to do these things. And, you know, at one time, Winona provided all of these things that we now fund. And as the money has dried up, we have taken over more and more of these things. And I suspect that this is the same in many, many districts. In 05 and 06, we gave out 26 grants for a variety of things for a total of about $28,000. And in 06-07, we provided 20 grants for about a little over $25,000. And we could do much, much more if we had a few more resources. So we're very interested in this bill. And like I said, to give you a flavor of some of the things that we do, we've given scholarships for participation in after-school activities, and I think it's very, very important that these kids have something to do after school and not go home to an empty house. We've provided uniforms for a number of organizations, both athletic and other organizations. We've provided scholarships for conferences, for out-of-town items, and we have a sister city in Japan, and we send a contingency of students from Winona to that town, and they reciprocate. And in fact, they were just here in town a few weeks ago. Well, I know we're going to be asked to set up a fund to provide scholarships within the district for students who are on free or reduced lunch to be able to participate in a number of activities, mostly after school activities. And we have given money for students to participate in what they call down there model legislature, which is kind of put on by Representative Pawlowski from our district. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of some of the things that that we've done, and we hope to be able to continue to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time of the committee today. We are admittedly a little bit outside the box, at least it is for me. But this is an attempt to take a look at something a little bit different for a five-year period of time and then evaluate it and see how we're doing. And if we're doing well, as was the case in Pennsylvania, we expand it. If it doesn't have the impact that we hoped, then the sun sets in place. I understand the difficult budget times we're in as well. And so bringing this to you, I understand what the kind of price tag to it is not easy. But on the other hand, I feel pretty passionately about our need to find options for reaching some of the kids who have the greatest needs in Minnesota.
Senator Larson, I'm interested in it, but, I mean, to be perfectly honest with everybody that's here, this is going to be a tough budget year to do it. But I did think the committee needed to have an overview of this. I am I'm a little concerned about the notion of 100% credit. And somebody please come see me if I'm wrong. But if you allow 100% credit and they still get the deduction on their federal return, I think essentially there's a – you know, there's almost a double dipping there, it seems to me, that they end up getting more money back than they actually made in a contribution by allowing 100%. So I think we need to think about that a little bit. I'm not sure 100% credit is quite the right idea in that I don't think we want them to get more of a tax advantage back than their liability was. So if we can think about that, I think.
I think both that issue, what I also take from today is we need to work on how we identify the qualifying students and also the qualifying schools. It sounds like we got to do some ratcheting up there in terms of further targeting, and certainly willing to do that and work with the committee to accomplish that.
Any other questions, members? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, Senator Larson. I appreciate your work on this. I know that it's been mentioned that Senator Olson worked on that for many years. But I honestly believe that the first approach should be to allow the tax credit for the families that are paying tuition directly to the low-income families that are finding a way to pay for tuition, and it's a bill that I've carried for 4 years here in the tax committee. I appreciate the fact that these contributions are being made, but I think the tax should incent the families that are making the initial outlay first and the charitable contributions second. And right now we've got families that are suffering because they are paying for this tuition, and they're also paying through the tax structure for public schools that they're not using. And I, for one, think that that's a more straightforward approach. I think incrementalism is about all we're going to get at the Capitol. I think we do one step at a time, and so I'm going to support your bill. But I hope that this committee, and I hope in the future, that Senate will look again at providing tax credits directly to the families who are paying for these services. What you're going to do is help the people that can't otherwise afford to send their children to the private schools. But I think that there are many families that are finding a way, scraping through second and third jobs, to pay for those schools. And so I hope that you will support my bill when it gets a hearing here, hopefully, and I will support yours. But I honestly think that we probably need both approaches, but my first interest would be to helping those families.
Well, Senator Larson, Senator Ortman, if you look at the language in the bill, the parents of the eligible student are eligible to receive scholarships. So, I mean, the money can go to more than just the school. It could go to the parents as a recipient of the scholarship. Am I reading that right, Senator Larson? So I think this is a bit of a hybrid, but I do think it accomplishes some of what you're thinking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct, and but you know, it's also important for me to underscore that this isn't an effort just to provide funding for scholarships for private schools. This is as much for public schools as it is for private schools. And I know that's difficult for folks to, and it's been, frankly, difficult for some of my friends in the public school community to embrace that's in fact an equal goal in this, but it really is. And I felt that personally. The reason that I'm excited about this is that appeal has come to me from my school district, that we just can't live with the amount of money that we're able to raise either through state funds or through our levy. We've got more needs, and if we don't meet them, they'll go unmet. And so that provides us our challenge, both from a private perspective and a public perspective. But you're right, Mr. Chair, the parents can access that.
Senator Larson, I think you're right. I think there are a lot of public school foundations that would go out and search for corporate money if they thought we created a vehicle for them that would, you know, make it more likely they'd be successful. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, the concern I have with that is it's a great program. Who doesn't want more money available for students and families of students and schools? The problem is now you've got the private sector with these contributions, and then the transparency is gone. How much does it cost to educate a student in the state of Minnesota? We need now corporate contributions and charitable contributions, and it just gets more and more complex, and we become more and more dependent on outside sources of funds. I think the more direct we can make the system, the more transparent the system, all the better. But as I said, I think we're in the business of incrementalism around here. We try to do what we can to fix problems as best we can with the money we have and the resources and the consensus we can build. So I support what you're doing. I will vote for it. I think there are probably more direct ways to accomplish it that I would prefer, but I support what you're doing, and I hope that you will support my efforts to make this more direct and to make it more transparent.
Senator Ortman, as long as your approach is constitutional. I mean, I think there is a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, on vouchers, I think that's correct. But on the tax credits, there's never been a challenge to the tax credits for education or tuition that I'm aware of.
Anything else, members? Senator Larson, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 3043 for possible inclusion in the committee bill.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman,
good luck.
Is there an opportunity to speak?
Did you want to testify?
Yes.
Okay, no, please, and then Senator Olson's next.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Renee Lara. I am representing Education Minnesota.
I speak to you not just as a representative of Education Minnesota, but also as a former student of color, a former a student eligible for the free and reduced lunch program, and also a former altar boy. Mr. Chairman, Education Minnesota has a very simple and straightforward position on this legislation. One of our main principles says that Education Minnesota opposes the diversion of local, state, or federal tax dollars to private, for-profit, or religious schools or educational programs through a voucher system, an income tax credit for tuition and fees, or income tax deductions for tuition and fees for education programs. There's no doubt that this piece of legislation falls under that category. Just last week, we were told that the teachers were no longer eligible for this past tax year for a deduction on their income tax, for the state income tax, for classroom supplies of up to $250. That item would have cost $1 million. This proposal, we understand, cost up to $10 million. We don't see how the state can afford to pay for that and not have money to pay for deductions for classroom teachers' supplies. The schools eligible for this program would not be subject to the state's testing and accountability regime. There's an accountability provision in here that calls for an auditor to look at the schools, but there is no requirement that the schools, the private schools, be subject to testing standards, just like the public schools. And there are a number of other provisions we did not have time to look through since we just found out about this bill yesterday, last night, that the private schools would not be subject to in the same way that as private schools. The one example that you would probably hear you may be able to connect is a bill that we just finished working with Senator Saltzman on that would require school districts, the employer school districts, to check on teachers' disciplinary action background for cases of sexual misconduct. That is an example of what private schools would not be subject to, and they would not be required to check for those types of things. We can certainly look at the long list of things that private schools would not be subject to under this provision, and we will be glad to forward those to you. So that is our short testimony on this bill. I am sure that as other education organizations find out about this legislation, since they also have in their platforms opposition to tax credits, you will also hear from them. Thank you so much.
I think I guess I would appreciate if Education Minnesota could share with me some thoughts about what we're going to do about the achievement gap. I mean we clearly have a problem, and it appears like just putting more money on the formula is not getting at it. And I think, and I don't know if this is it, but I would be interested in the observations of Education Minnesota as to how we can do a better job of closing that achievement gap. We've got some populations of people where we're not doing very well. And I'm interested if they've got an idea outside just putting more money on the formula. I'm interested in it.
Mr. Chairman, the achievement gap is a national problem that is probably the biggest problem for the long term and for the short term for the sake of our economic survival, really, because the students whose population is growing the most are the students who need the most help. We have large groups of students from poor educational backgrounds whose parents are not as well educated, who do not come to school as prepared as kids from suburban or middle class backgrounds. We certainly need to address that. There have been many attempts, and we're continuing to work on that. I can assure you that tax credits for corporations is not the answer to that problem. These children need to go to high quality schools with lower class sizes, not growing class sizes like we're having now due to the tax budget cuts. These children need to be in front of well-qualified, certified teachers. So we can certainly talk about that huge problem. This is not the fix to that problem.
Mr. Chair.
I guess I didn't suggest that it was a fix, but I think people, there are people, I think, trying to find, put another tool in the box to try and close that. And I think Senator Larson's interest in this, I think, is I think it's a reasonable discussion for the committee to have. It's a pretty, and I'm not at all indicating this is going to be in the bill because it costs $10 million, but $10 million when we spend $14 billion on K-12 seems pretty modest.
Mr. Chairman, this is a, I'm assuming that the proponents of this bill would not want to be limited to $10 million and would like this program to grow. As in the case of charter schools, that program at first, at least one of our unions we're affiliated with, the American Federation of Teachers, pushed and promoted that experiment as a way for public schools to learn from experiments in education. And what that has turned out to be is a huge program with some bright spots, but a lot of problematic spots. And that program has grown beyond what it was originally intended to grow. The charter schools have not become laboratories of innovation. They have become an entire different institutional part of the school system.
Senator Squay.
Well, not to the witness, but just to general comment to the committee. You know, I think this is something that it's good that we're having this discussion. I really think it is. I do have one concern, and this has to do with the constitutional requirement of a uniform education. And as we've moved toward voter-approved referendum to fund schools, we've put disparity in our schools. We just, everybody knows that. And we want to, if we do this, we want to make sure that this doesn't aggravate that disparity, because some parts of the state don't have large corporations or anybody to make these contributions to foundations. And so while we're working through this, Senator Larson, that would certainly be something that, you know, we need to be kind of looking at to make sure that we're meeting that uniform condition.
Thank you. Senator Bach, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Scoy, and I appreciate you raising that. We had an opportunity to visit about this over the summer, or sometime during the fall, I recall, and that's something that is continues to be in my mind and trying to work through some potential solutions to perhaps spread some of those dollars that are received in terms of corporate contribution. And so that's something I'm willing to work with you and the committee on to try to find some way of addressing that issue.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Larson, or Senator Olson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson has Senate File 2717, and we have a technical amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have the A1 author's amendment, which basically puts the bill in the form that I'd like to have it considered. It simply clarifies, at the suggestion of counsel, the language that we should use to make sure that we're referring correctly to purchased and leased vehicles by a school district.
Counsel, what does the amendment do?
Mr. Chair, the amendment, as Senator Olson said, just clarifies that the leases are subject to sales tax under 297A and the purchases are subject to the motor vehicle sales tax under 297B.
Senator Scoy moves the A1 amendment. Discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Olson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is a suggestion that was actually brought to me by Rick Scogan, who's here at my right and will be testifying on behalf of this bill. He's the business administrator for the Pequot Lakes School District and has been very proactive in looking for ways that the school district could incorporate things that are environmentally friendly, setting a good example for students, and at the same time saving money for the school district, as good business administrators do, looking for ways to save money. Mr. Scogan had familiarity with propane-fueled school buses, and they were in fact in use in Pequot Lakes until about 2002. And then because of some technological issues that he will explain to you, they basically went out of use. But recently, because of some innovations in propane-fueled technology, they have become a very not only viable but a very good alternative for school districts. They are, the cost of propane is roughly historically been about half the cost of gas, and they are much more environmentally friendly in terms of their emissions. They meet all the California emission standards and are widely in use in that state. The difficulty is that there's about a $12,000 additional cost in purchasing one of these buses as compared to an overall bus. And while there is, even considering that $12,000 cost, there is a long-term savings for the school district. There's an initial upfront cost that makes it more difficult to purchase these environmentally friendly and safer buses. We all know that in rural Minnesota, the cost of transportation with the increasing cost of gas has become a bigger and bigger burden for our school districts that have to cover a lot of miles, and they've been asking us to do something to help with that. We also know that we have limitations with our present budget challenges, and so we really don't have additional money to put in to meet these to help school districts with the added costs of transportation. This would be one thing we could do to move in the direction of giving some relief to school districts, where the more miles they're driving, the more savings they would be able to achieve, and we'd be able to do this for a relatively small cost. You can see that the fiscal note assumes that not everyone is going to go right out and buy one of these buses, but as they are purchased over time, estimated that between 3 to 5 a year may be purchased, we're moving in the right direction for a relatively small cost. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Scogan, who will walk you through the advantages of this proposed legislation.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Chair and members of the Tax Committee, my name is Rick Scogan. I'm the business manager of the Pequot School District. And I want to thank you for allowing me to come and talk to you today, such as the committee has left. I spent most of my career in private business. I was a manager at Cragen's Lodge for most of my life. And recently, some would say retired, but I think this job has been a lot harder than managing Cragen's in a lot of respects. But when I was at Cragen's, there were many opportunities for businesses to take advantage of various incentives to do things, tax credits. And business currently has a 50% tax credit through the federal government for the investment in propane technology. Propane technology, as Senator Olson said very clearly, was available up until 2002 for school districts. And in Pequot, before I came there, they ran dual fuel buses, propane gasoline. And without getting a lot of technical stuff going on here, because I don't know it myself, the technology changed and the propane dual fuel bus was not allowed to be used after 2002. So Pequot bought diesel buses. Now we have $3.75 diesel we're paying for. I do have a futures fixed price contract for the propane buses that we have at $1.56 a gallon. That doesn't exactly equate to, it isn't apples and apples, but it's like $2 gasoline. Well, I can't buy a $2 gasoline anywhere, maybe outside of Brazil. So there's a company called Clean Fuel USA, which is a developed technology through a European company to allow school buses to now use propane again. That said, it's $12,000 additional cost. Business has an incentive to do that. School districts don't. I'm looking for ways to try to save the school district money. We're doing investment in building improvements. We're trying to do some stuff with the Johnson Controls and a wind farm. This is just one more piece for us to try to save money, to try to spend less money on energy and more money on kids. And it doesn't cost the state a lot because I think at this time it's going to be minimal. Hopefully, though, it'll catch on. And I'll tell you why it's important for it to catch on. The propane technology is not only cheaper, but the noxious emissions from propane are substantially less than from either gasoline or from diesel, and they meet all of the California standards through 2010, and I know they're more stringent than Minnesota standards. There's a line in this handout today that disturbed me when I read it, and I didn't know this myself. A recent U.S. Department of Energy Clean Cities publication reported no alternative school buses in Minnesota of the approximately 4,000
alternative nationwide, 70% are in California and Minnesota. I think we do a disservice to our children by teaching them conservation and not walking the walk on the other end. But my point is simply that we ought to say what we're doing, or we ought to do what we're saying. Excuse me. I think we can invest in this technology. I think it'll be cheaper long term. It puts us on a level playing field with businesses, and it doesn't cost a lot up front. And one of the questions that may come up is propane safe. Well, Pequot has been fueling their own buses since the 1980s with propane. The bus drivers are comfortable with it. The mechanic is comfortable working on the buses. So we're very, very comfortable, and we've never had a parent complain about propane in Pequot since I've been there in the 2 years, and I don't think before that. So questions, Senator?
Mr. Slogan, the buses that Pequot currently has that are propane, were those conversions?
Were they conversions? They're a dual-fuel conversion, and back then the cost of the conversion, Senator, Mr. Chair, was substantially less than $12,000. The technical reason, and this isn't technical because I'm not a techie guy, but the reason that things changed is prior to 2002, the injector systems were vaporizing the fuels as they came in, and propane was an easily vaporized fuel, so it was fairly cheap to use the dual fuel. Since 2002, there's a new process that injects the fuels into the cylinders as a liquid, not as a vapor anymore, and propane didn't work that well with that until this company came along, Clean Fuel USA, and developed a liquid injection system, which is now available. And it eliminates the dual fuel issue, but it does, as I say, cost about $12,000
extra. Mr. Skogan, the revenue analysis that we got from the department says that of the three primary bus manufacturers nationwide, one of them produces propane fuel systems. Do we run the risk of creating this tax exemption and then that one producer out there just going to raise the price of the bus by that amount? Is there any competition in the market?
There is currently no competition in the market that I'm aware of. Bluebird and General Motors are the companies that are producing this particular vehicle nationwide. The Clean Fuel USA company has come up with a process to make this work with an 8.1 liter engine, and I don't know what that equates to, but apparently General Motors has an 8.1 liter engine. I think if it caught on, certainly Carpenter and Thomas, is that the other name of this, whoever they are, can certainly figure out a way to make this work. I'm not supporting any particular company, by the way. I'm just looking for technology to try to save a school district a buck or two.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. I think this is a real interesting idea. I do have kind of a technical issue with it, and I don't know if maybe you can work with Senate counsel as this moves along. The bill language is dealing with school districts that buy buses, but a number of school districts have contracts with private carriers, and we'd have to figure out if you want them to be able to access this program or not, and work through that because they wouldn't be included here, right. But a lot of school districts do contract their buses out
most.
To other companies. Most.
Of most. Them. Senator Olson, to that point?
Mr. Chair, again, I'm not a tax expert, so maybe counsel can help us out with this, but it's my understanding, as Mr. Skogan said, that business already has tax credits that they get for purchasing a number of different kinds of environmentally friendly products, but that those are not tax credits that have applied to school districts. And so the school district buses that are leased from private industry or purchased outright would be covered by this bill. But when they're simply contracting with a private industry, at least as the bill is written now, this would not include those. But I think that they have other tax incentives that they can take advantage of because they are private companies that would again, I'm not an expert in that area, but I'm assuming since there are those kinds of credits for private industries that they may have some advantages that the school districts can't take advantage of.
Senator Olson, Mr. Chair, Senator Skill, I'm not a tax expert either. but the Environmental Protection Agency has allowed a 50% tax credit for the incremental cost of this technology to private business. You could certainly check with the Senate Council, but my strong suspicion is that if I were a private contractor, I'm already I could avail myself of that credit currently if I chose to do so.
Well,
Senator, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if the there's a fair number of school buses in Minnesota that are owned by these private companies, and I mean it probably isn't sufficient if there's zero of these alternative buses in Minnesota. So I would suggest that we work to include those companies in this provision if this moves forward.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I would certainly be very open to giving them this advantage as well. I'm sure it would increase the fiscal note, but the fiscal note isn't very large to begin with, and this is something that we definitely want to, if we can not only save money, but do something that's environmentally friendly. I mean, those are the kinds of win-win situations I think that we've been looking for, where we know that there's technology already out there and available that we could accomplish that purpose with. And then one other comment I wanted to make is a question that I asked for Mr. Scogan, and it's in the materials that you were given. I was wondering, from a safety standpoint, what happens if one of these buses gets into an accident? Are they as safe as a gas-powered bus? And in fact, there's information in the materials that says that their point that they would explode is at a significantly higher temperature than gas bus, I think more than twice the temperature. And so they're actually considered a safer bus for students to be riding if the bus gets into an accident.
Senator Olson, I think either you or I need to have a discussion with Senator Murphy, because the tax exemption we're creating here actually comes out of the gas tax, out of the highway user fund. It's not because that money flows to the highway user fund. So it really is, small as it is, Senator Murphy should know that we're considering this, because it's not general fund dollars. That sales tax on vehicles goes to the highway fund, highway user fund. So he may either want to see the bill, but he needs to be made comfortable. He needs to know that we're considering. So if you could visit with him about it.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. And I'd also be happy to work with Senator Scogan to make sure that the language, or excuse me, Senator Skoy, to make sure that the language encompasses all school buses, if that's the desire of this committee to do that.
Well, Senator Olson, Senator Skoy, and I may Senator Skoy and I may need to have a discussion about this, because I'm not sure that those private companies are going to pass these savings on to the school districts in their contracts. So I don't think we want to create a situation where a private company is able to get a tax exemption, but there's never actually a benefit to the public school district. So I think we got to think about that a little bit. Senator Skoy, am I thinking right?
You're thinking right, Mr. Chair. We'll have a little discussion about that.
Anything else, Maurice?
No, Mr. Chair.
Chair lays over Senate file 2717 as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Olson, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Tax Committee.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dahl, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you very much. First time I've really been here.
I hope it's a pleasurable experience for you.
I'm sure it will be. I have Senate File 3533, and try to be as brief as possible, and my testifiers have promised to be brief as well. I'm going to introduce Kent Solem first. He's with the Minnesota Township Associations. I'll let him describe what this bill does for you.
Mr. Solem, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And this is a bill that was brought forward because of a situation that arose in Washington Township. But while working with legislative members on the appropriate fix, the decision was, if we're going to do it for one, we might as well just make it work for all. And I'll let the next testifier explain the details of the specifics in Washington Township. But the bottom line was is that subordinate service districts are created by a petition of the residents, and it's usually a small cluster of residents that want an enhanced service, something that is not offered to everybody in the township. And in exchange for receiving that service, they agree to pay either a service charge or a surplus levy on their property tax. And so this occurred in Washington Township, and then the service in that situation was a cluster septic such situation, and that is no longer needed, so they disbanded the district. But at the time the district was disbanded, the fees had already been collected for the year, and so there was a substantial amount of money no longer needed for the intended purpose. And the town's attorney called me, and we worked for months trying to find a way that they could return the funds to the people who had paid it, because they're not getting the service that they were paying for. You know, these were the extra monies paid for the extra service. The extra service was no longer being provided or needed because of changed circumstances. And there was no way in law that we could find to legally return the extra payment. And so modeling it after some language that exists currently for special assessments that are put on for projects that are never built, we came up with this language and ask for your full support of this concept.
This is Dean Deutscher. He lives out there in Washington Township. Go ahead.
I do. My name is Dean Deutscher. My official address is Mankato, Minnesota. I live on, I have a home on Lake Washington. 14 of us tried to be good citizens and make a difference in the water quality on our lake. And as a result of that, what we did was buy 2 acres of land some distance away and then put in a sewer line to service all 14 of us. We bought the land and put in the system. It cost us about $15,000 per person, per house. And we installed this system that served everybody along the lake in that area. After we did that, the entire lake decided, gee, it would be a good idea to do something like that around the entire lake, and convinced the city of Mankato that we would like to send all of our sewage to Mankato. And so we joined that effort, and we paid another $15,000 to do that. Now, being good citizens, we didn't want to really lose our $15,000. As a result of our deal, Washington Township had bought 2 acres of land somewhere away from the lake, but still having some value. And this land is no longer needed by anybody on the lake, including the members along this sanitary sewer district that we created. And so we thought what was fair, since we paid 100% of the bill, that if we could get a return by selling that land, at least we would get some of our investment that we made about 8 years prior to a citywide system being installed. And so I worked long and hard with the Washington Township Board on this for many, 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 many months. And Washington Township Board agrees with this. LeSueur County agrees with this. And we thought it was a fair thing to do.
Mr. Deutscher, thank you. Senator Dahl, I think you're right. I think it's a pretty simple little bill. Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, do we know how much will be recovered by the sale of these 2 acres?
Do you have an answer to that?
We used to think we knew, but everything's gone down in value. So right. We bought the acres. When we initially bought them, we spent $20,000. And we would hope to maybe get that plus maybe another 20 out of it, maybe 40 total, which would go, you know, pay $2,000 or $3,000 toward our $15,000 assessment. It's not going to be a windfall, but it would go to help offset our initial contributions.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, actually, I was concerned that given the state of where real estate is these days, I didn't know what the market was like in your area, and it certainly didn't seem like you would be getting a great deal out of it, and I didn't know if this bill was time-restricted in terms of when the sale would happen if this did become law, that whether or not that you would have some time to assess the market,
yeah,
or that there was some time issue where you would have to sell within sell the property within a certain amount of time. I didn't know that if it was contemplated.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ma, I appreciate that comment. There's no question we had higher hopes for the value of this land than we do now. And I don't know about the time sensitivity here.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ma, there is no time restriction in terms of when they'd have to sell the property. It's tied back that any surplus revenues that the district would hold would go back to those who paid in. The last time payment was made, we did have to do that because there has to be some way of identifying in a non-complex manner who actually is entitled to the refund. And so it would go, it's based on the last payment into the district, but it's not restricted as to when they sell the property.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, I would recommend to Senator Dahl that you think about that, because while we want to have some flexibility to have maximum recovery of the sale of the land to maximize the benefit to the contributors, you also don't want this thing to hang out there in perpetuity or for a long, long, long time, making it difficult, I think, to then ultimately make the transaction happen to return the money to who the players are. And you might want to even think about sunsetting this provision, because I don't know if you would want it permanently in the law once this has happened.
Mr. Sol?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ma, the difference is that we purposely drafted this to apply to any situation, not just the Washington Township situation. So this is actually trying to establish what I think everybody agrees was good state policy, that anytime a district is abolished, and again, a district is only shut down upon the request of those who are being serviced by it. So it's all generated by the property owners who ask for it to be created and then petition for it to shut down. And so I wouldn't like to see the entire provision sunset if we need to look at doing something specifically for the land sale, because usually that's not the situation. It's normally not trying to dispose of an asset to liquefy the assets. Usually it is straight cash that's on hand. It's already revenues held, but it's revenues paid by a small number of people above and beyond the normal taxes. So that's what we're dealing with.
Senator Ma, is that a satisfactory answer?
I'd mix the two, and I'm clear that they're separate issues.
Thank you.
Limiting factor.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Deutscher, I just want to congratulate you for leading the way on this. Mm-hmm. I wish that all of the heavily developed lakes across the state had that type of facility around them, including the one that I'm on. And I really think, I mean, this is a really great story of a group of people showing leadership.
Thank you, Senator. You know, I sold this to everybody by saying, what do you think the value of this lake would be if it was clean? We'd recoup our money 100 times over, and we still didn't get 100% of the people to agree. But no deed goes unpunished, you know. No good deed.
No good deed goes unpunished, right.
Senator Dalt, in talking with counsel, I think we might have to do a little bit of work here, because it says that you had to have a liability within the preceding tax year. Mm. So if there is, Mr. Solom, if we're looking at what if it was 2 years, what if the liability ended 2 years ago or 3 years
right.
ago?
Right.
So Mr. Solom? Mr. Chair, perhaps we came up with, I would say that the intent was to try to get the last payment made, that we tie it, you know, so maybe there's a way that council could advise us how we could reword that. But that was the intent, is to say that the rebate goes based on the last time that there was this service fee or extra payment, so we're not trying to go back and figure out 10-year averaging of what they've paid and that sort of thing.
But what if the petition comes, a year to get the petition? I mean, you know, people are snowbirds or whatever on a lake, and you need to
At that point, the district would continue. You wouldn't, the abolishment of the district doesn't happen until the petition is done, and so the fees are always going to be paid in. I think the situation that we're addressing here would be if the sale of the assets exceeds the tax year, would they be entitled to a rebate? And that our intent is yes, and if that's not clear enough here, I'd be happy to work with council on the technical fix. But what we were trying to do was to make sure that it's
the identified parties are based on the last year a fee was imposed.
Okay. It might need a little technical fix, I think, in talking with counsel. But so if you could work with counsel to make sure
Certainly.
We get that. Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3533 for possible inclusion in the committee. Senator Dahl, thank you.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Chair.
Senator Chaudhry. Senator Chaudhry, welcome to the committee. And I think, which bill would you like to go with first?
Take Fridley first, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 3260. And members, this bill substantially, I believe, was in the first tax bill that we passed into law. So I think we do have an amendment, I think, that is... in addition to the language that was passed and signed by the governor last Friday, and it's a delete everything because of the 2008 bill that was already passed. So Senator Moi moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 3260.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill as well as the next one. The Fridley TIF bill that's before you, as well as the New Brighton TIF that we'll hear afterwards, are amendments to the TIF legislation that we proposed last year, was included in the tax bill, was vetoed, and then included in this year's tax bill. And then signed into law. Because of the year delay, there have been resulting gaps in funding, and we sought these amendments to the tax bill that was signed into law last week, but were advised that to avoid opening up a can of worms, we should seek these amendments in a later tax bill. So that's what we're here to do. And to provide an explanation of the changes and the modifications are the Mayor Fridley and Jim Casserly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. Scott Lund, Mayor Fridley, and my focus is brief and to just enlighten everyone as to why this immediate change or amendment. Just for clarification, if for nothing else, instead of calling it one large TIF district, to more adequately describe it as a project area, it is unrealistic to have the clock start ticking when one project starts in this very large area. In reality, the projects, there will be several projects, and therefore the need for this amendment and asking for continuation so that the clock doesn't start ticking once one small area, one project area, gets the TIF funding, and then we're under the timeline. So this amendment asks for a continuance of up to 10 years, as you will note in line 9, under H, that asks for a continuance of that these project areas to continue or start in increment during that period of time. I passed out, or hopefully the page has passed out, a little map of the district, and it shows, and I apologize that it's not in color at the last minute. Maybe it is. And you will see that there's some circled areas that we already are in discussions with these areas as being redevelopment project areas. And they would come to the lower one on the, where it's marked partial number 30 is something that we believe that will probably take go into effect within a year. The other one is, and there's differences. As we all know, the market's up and down right now. Obviously, residential is way down. The other circled area that's for parcels number 1 through 14, that was talked about recently, about a year or 18 months ago, for a multi-housing or multi-family redevelopment project. But with the downticking already a year and a half ago of residential, timing is everything. We all know that. So these projects are going to happen incrementally at different times, and therefore we feel that the need for this amendment. This really relates to, as one of our oldest areas in Fridley, there is a number of infrastructure needs. We have even one parcel here that the homeowner is still on well and septic. He's not even hooked up to our municipal sewage system, unbelievable as it is. So we do have a number of areas, projects in this area that require a bridge, potentially a bridge for an east-west corridor connection, also for utilities and for roads. So with that in mind, we feel that the need obviously was there for the TIF district. I thank everyone for that, getting into legislation last Friday, and then hope that there is not a lot of problems with or this amendment that we feel that it's really necessary to really define this whole large area. So with that, if there's anything to add by Mr. Casserly, or if there are questions from the committee.
Mr. Casserly?
Mr. Chairman, really there isn't. This is really allowing us to create more than one tax increment district within this defined project area. And had we put it together initially, had we thought of that initially, we would have included it. But after that's the real reason the bill's back before you.
Mr. Kessley, I remember the discussion we had about the tunnel, and there's a public safety issue there. But this expands it on lines 1.27 to allow access to the North Star commuter rail. What does that mean, allow access? What are we trying to do there?
I think that language was inserted to make it very clear that any of the infrastructure that's being included, it allows us to access. The station is at the north end of this project area, and we are going to have a park and ride facility. There's going to be other infrastructure improvements that will get us into the station. The station actually is accessed by a elevator system. This is unlike some of the other stations. And you are going to go underneath and then use elevators to actually use the station itself. So we just wanted to make sure that all of the various kinds of infrastructure improvements that related both to the station and in the adjacent area were eligible. And if the term of art needs to be refined, we'd be happy to do that. It's I don't think our intention was to allow some major expansion. It was really designed to do just that. We have roads that really need to be put in, and we have other infrastructure that needs to be dealt with.
I think, Mr. Casserly, we might want more of a definition of what that access issue is.
Okay.
We have some idea.
Sure.
I mean, what is it more than the tunnel, I think, is probably what we want to know.
Okay.
The house is pretty tough on this kind of stuff, so I think we probably could help improve our argument some with the house if we had it, I think, defined a little bit more.
Mr. Chairman, we'll define that exactly, or we'll go back and try to revisit why it is we thought it was necessary in the first place. Oftentimes we will do things just to make our life simpler in terms of interpretation. And enough said.
We just would like to know what it means.
Okay.
Anything, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3260 as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Chaudhry, Senate File 3512, New Brighton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a similar issue, but in a different way. The similarity being that the length of time that has passed since the last veto and now have increased the cost of the city in environmental cleanup, and combined with the failure of our bonding proposal to be included in either of the House or Senate versions for a methane processor, have increased the need for us to rely on ourselves to make this environmental cleanup project happen so that we can move on with redevelopment of the Northwest Quadrant, which is currently a kind of a combination of a construction landfill, a former asphalt plant, and I think there's some other industrial topics there as well. But to explain it in more detail is Mayor of New Brighton and our city administrator.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson, Mayor of New Brighton. Pleasure to be here, Senators. What we're talking about is a project that, for those of you that don't know, is on the corner of 694-35W. Started out, we were going to look at redeveloping 100 acres. As soon as we managed to purchase all the property, found out that 10% of that would probably be non-biddable because of the geotechnical issues underneath an old refinery and an old, actually it was being used actively as an asphalt plant. We knew about the contamination with the oil supply and the solvents, and what we found out is that there's probably 40 feet of muck, peat, underneath it. And MPCA increased their cleanup costs by probably two or three times just to try to clean that up, because they won't let us go down and just clean out the contamination, because as you clean up, more and more stuff will go down into the geotechnical problem area, and therefore we'd be cleaning up 40 feet of it. So we can't afford to do that. Costs are astronomical. So when in the process, we let a bid to try to clean out what we could and move it so we could consolidate it in a 10-acre span and allow us to do the other 90 acres. Well, during that process, we now have found that when the Superfund cleanup happened many years ago by Ashland, they, instead of complying, buried some of their tanks and pipelines instead of removing them. And we found that when we started excavation process. So another ball of it's a mess. And I am very uncomfortable with looking at my citizens' main paving for all of this out of their tax dollars. Try to keep taxes down. This could cost 10 to 20% increase in our levy just to cover some of this unless we get the pooling so we can go into the cleanup costs. We have a dump that needs a methane collection system. We have a seven-story hotel that wants to go in immediately, but we have to get the wrap approved by the MPCA to allow us to clean up the corner of that property and start going with the hotel. If you see in the back page of the material, I think you all have, we have a color photo showing the red spots, appropriate color, putting us all in the red. Deal with the cleanup of an old dump and with the contamination up in the old asphalt plant and refinery. And if we get the approval from MPCA, we can start using some of the funds that exist in TIF District 9 and 20 towards this project of cleaning up and installing the methane recovery system, which is, you know, very, very important for us. And this is going to stop us from having to go to the tax dollar, because otherwise it's got to come out of the levy. We've tapped it. We're $84 million in. Yeah, we got about 74 million, 72, whatever. It varies every year. It changes by about $2 million. So the pooling and the extension of this district, since everything went south when Medtronic left, we had to start all over again. And they went to Moundsview, and now we look at Plan B. But we're stuck between a rock and a hard spot, and it's not fun.
So, Mr. Mayor, how much, I mean, by including districts 9 and District 20, how much new money are we talking about?
It's 6.8.
Per year?
That's it.
One time.
Yep. And that basically would cover the methane recovery system and all the needs that are there to make that a viable option. And we're still looking at whether we're going to be required to have a passive or an active recovery system.
members again because the new Brighton provisions passed into law were signed in last Friday. There is a delete everything amendment to the bill. It's the A1. Senator Moore moves the A1. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Chaudhry, anything further?
I don't think, Mr. Chair, I have anything else to add.
I think the committee, Mr. Mayor, understands the dilemma that you're in. Members, anything?
Mr. Chair, these two projects have been around for a long time, and to the extent that we can help to not continue to give them the budget shortfall, I think that it would be good to get them done.
Mr. Mayor, is 4 years going to do this?
Well, I defer that to you.
Mr. All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dean Lauder. I'm the city manager of New Brighton. Thank you for allowing us to speak to you on these issues today. We actually had kind of a three-pronged approach to some of our dilemmas with the Northwest Quadrant. One was a bonding request, which unfortunately didn't make it into the bill. However, the two items that are really before you today are the ability to pool TIF Districts 9 and 20, along with some changes with TIF District 26. And then what we're also looking for is essentially to be kind of grandfathered into when TIF districts are allowed to move forward with their timing. Our TIF district clocks have already started ticking, and what we'd like to be able to do is capture a few more years at the end of those TIF districts so that we can hopefully recover some of those costs and turn our deficit around at least to a break even. So I think the answer to the question is our projections are that 4 years extensions would work as far as the TIF extension is concerned.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, and we appreciate that. I'd like to say it, we need 7 years, but if the figures, if everything goes like we're planning on now, 4 years should do it, and why should we go for any more?
Right. Well,
I don't think it's appropriate.
The committee appreciates it. Mm-hmm. Chair lays over Senate File 3512 as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Chaudhry, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chair of the Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that okay? It is.
I think so.
They got some legitimate issues, I think. So. Anything else, members?
We're meeting again when?
Members, the Property Tax Division is going to meet tomorrow. The full committee will meet again on Tuesday. Committee's adjourned.
Thanks for all the time, Tom.